Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tabiri. Today, conversations about partisan gerrymandering, a controversial bill moving at the North Carolina House, and opening day. Your guest is a State House reporter from the Associated Press who is back on the Politics Podcast, Gary Robertson. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Glad you are here and glad we get to discuss some of what happened in hashtag NCPaul this week. We're going to start with what strikes me as some good red meat from a policy standpoint, this controversial bill pertaining to immigration and dealing with what is a divide between sheriffs in the state. Tell us a little bit more about this ICE proposal.
Well, first of all, some of your listeners may know that a number of new sheriffs were elected in urban counties this year, and a few of them ran on the idea of distancing the work of their sheriff's offices from federal immigration agents' work, particularly the 287G program and also what are called ICE detainers, which basically tell or ask a jail or a sheriff's office to hold someone who they think who is a defendant and who might be unlawfully in the country. And so after they won, maybe a handful of sheriffs reversed the course for their sheriff's offices, said we won't cooperate with ICE or we will not participate in the 287G program. So this bill filed by House Republicans, including, I believe, House Speaker Tim Moore, who is among the co-sponsors, says your sheriffs, all sheriffs in all 100 counties need to work with ICE on the issue of detainers. And when a document comes to you on that, you need to cooperate. And if you don't, you potentially could get a civil penalty if somebody decides to challenge that in litigation.
So unsurprisingly, some of the sheriffs who have indicated or who are not participating with federal compliance, if that's the right word, that compliance might not be the right word there. Unsurprisingly, we're talking about blue pockets of the state, right? We're talking about Raleigh and Asheville and Charlotte.
Those are the counties where either 287G is not being used anymore or they're not going to honor these detainers. So there is an element of partisanship to this, and some people would say, I talked with one advocate who said this is similar, she alleges, to what the Republicans did to Democratic Governor Roy Cooper when he took office, eroding the power of the office so that they would be weakened. I'm sure the Republicans, however, say this is just all about sheriffs should be helping enforce the law and they should be cooperating. And one of the bill sponsors, Representative Destin Hall of Caldwell County, referred to these sheriffs as sanctuary sheriffs and that they should be helping carry out the law rather than discouraging it.
And I think it's worth noting, you might have already mentioned this, clearly I'm under the weather if you can't tell that by listening, but some of the sheriffs in these blue pockets ran partially on this issue.
Yes.
That they were not going to be active in these detainments. And I think some of what we heard from the left this week was you're stifling the vote of the people. You're stifling the wishes of the voters who put these folks in office just a few months ago. So on the left, we heard a little bit about the fact that search and seizures, these detainments are unlawful. And on the right, we heard about the safety element here and that there's a safety component and that sheriffs need to just be abiding by the state and federal law.
Well, Representative Hall said that federal agents are going to enforce immigration laws regardless of whether or not sheriffs are involved. And so he said it can be done in the jail in a controlled environment, or it can be done out in the community. And as we saw earlier this month, there were hundreds of ICE-related arrests in North Carolina, and a regional ICE administrator said this is a direct result from the decision-making by some sheriffs to not cooperate. And so, again, the immigration advocates and their allies are saying this is this will be discouraging crime victims from coming forward because they may too be unlawfully in the country and therefore may worry that they will be removed from their families. The legislation attempts to say that if you are a witness to a crime, it wouldn't apply to you, but that there's a lot of trust issues that they're dealing with.
We're talking about sheriffs here. Where do police fall into this whole conversation? Why are we not talking about city police operations, if you know?
Well, police operations don't have jails. I can't speak to whether or not municipalities have holding areas. But primarily, the people that they arrest usually end up in the jail. For instance, a community, don't hold me to this, but I assume that communities in Wake County, like Knightdale or Fuquay Varina, are sending their suspects to the Wake County jail. Yep. And so it's the jail that really is holding these suspects.
Politically, as it pertains to this whole ICE debate, ICE conversation, I guess there are two things I want to get at a little bit, and I think one of your stories might have addressed this week. I think Republicans are making a push here because they want to get Governor Cooper on the record on this. I think that if we get maybe a little bit ahead of ourselves, they're daring him to veto this. I can hear the mailers now, right? Governor Cooper wants dangerous people in your backyard.
Well, immigration is still a hot button issue,
right?
And Democrats probably feel at times that they may be may have an Achilles heel on that in some areas of the state where the perception is that they are somehow weak on law enforcement on this issue. Governor Cooper's office put out a statement saying, that he'll review any bill, but he has concerns about what he calls efforts to make it harder for local law enforcement to do their jobs, and that's what he believes. This is what opponents of this bill say would make it harder for law enforcement to actually carry out the duties of finding people who are committing crimes and protecting victims.
I also wanted to get your two cents about putting this issue before all of the Republicans in the House, because I couldn't help but think about some of the Republicans in the North Carolina House, specifically representatives in urban or suburban districts, such as Ted Davis in New Hanover, Wilmington, Holly Grange, similarly New Hanover, Wilmington. You're thinking of John Hardister in Guilford, Eastern Greensboro. There was another one that I had in my head who, of course, I've forgotten at this point, Donnie Lambeth in Forsyth mm-hmm. County. I was wondering if this is the kind of issue that could potentially hurt some House Republicans as we think ahead to 2020.
Well, I think with every one of those legislators you talked about, again, I'm not talking, haven't spoken with them personally,
but
in each of those districts, I would bet a high percentage of unaffiliated voters. And it's just hard to know, and there are probably Republican consultants out there or Democratic consultants that could talk about this, but I would think that immigration is an issue that may play strongly among unaffiliated voters, whether positively or negatively. Maybe you need another guest on that.
Gary D. Robertson, you can follow him on Twitter at Gary D. Robertson, your guest here on the WDNC Politics Podcast. We're going to shift to a partisan gerrymandering challenge out of North Carolina that was before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. Plaintiffs sued over the North Carolina congressional maps, currently a 10-3 set of maps, and they were redrawn just about three years ago at this time, because they had been ruled illegal racial gerrymanders. But now, almost infamously, House Rules Chair David Lewis said he was proposing a new set of maps that would give Republicans a 10-3 advantage based on the criteria that the court had set forth that they use, because he, David Lewis, didn't think they could come up with maps that would give 11 Republicans the advantage here. So that has been called by some, mainly the challengers, a smoking gun statement. But the issue of partisan gerrymandering, which I think, if we're being honest, most people would agree is an issue. We do have partisan gerrymandering. If you say, those maps aren't a partisan gerrymander, you're not really being honest here. They are a partisan gerrymander. But, of course, partisan gerrymandering has been permissible in the country going back you know, 200 years or so now. So I'm going to start with a real doozy of a question here. But one of the things that the justices kept turning to Allison Riggs, attorney for League of Women Voters, North Carolina League of Women Voters on Tuesday in Washington, was, you know, what should be the standard and what should be considered extreme versus not extreme? So as we think about parties, I'm throwing you on the spot. You're not going to like this question. How do you look at that? Like, what is extreme versus isn't extreme? I mean, 10-3 is certainly a significant advantage. Is it extreme? What's extreme?
Well, isn't extreme in the eye of the beholder?
Sure.
And so, but I'm sure that if this state were regularly electing Democratic candidates statewide office by a 70-30 margin or a 60-40 margin.
Which is not happening recently.
No, right now everything is very evenly divided here. That would certainly get people's attention that there may be something amiss. But as I spoke with Representative David Lewis last week, talking about one measurement that the pro-redistricting reform advocates look at called the efficiency gap, which was a part of this litigation, he said, you know, we're not in a parliamentary system. And so just because doesn't mean that if there's 55% of the vote goes to Democrats and 45% to Republicans, that there needs to be a 55% of the seats going to Democrats. There's always going to be that probably tweak or adjustment between what this overall statewide vote is and what the actual number of seats that were won. There's also a question of we're not always going to be in a situation where, as we had in the 2018 legislative elections, where every district was essentially challenged. There was essentially 120 seats and at least two candidates in each one. That's by far not – that's the exception.
Right.
For most of this century, generally speaking, on election day – over half or close to half of the seats had already been decided. So that's going to result in a you're going to have a lot of districts where only one candidate is on the ballot. So how does that play out? How does it make it more complicated? And so it'll be interesting to see whether this three-prong test that I believe the three-judge panel provided, whether the justices think that's workable.
Right. And I believe, I'm not looking at my notes from Tuesday, but intent and effect, and then whether or not there's a way to justify a 10-3 advantage some other way. That's kind of that three-pronged test. We heard the word skeptical, wary. What word would you use to describe the court's enthusiasm or interest in wading into partisan gerrymandering? The U.S. Supreme Court, this is.
Oh, I think wary is probably a word because as we talked offline, they seem to have been wary for many years to really kind of say this is the line in the sand on a lot of different gerrymandering decisions, mostly racial gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been some criticisms, mainly from the Republicans because they've been in charge of maps here, that the rules keep constantly changing. And it seems as though that justices are wary of just setting hard and fast rules because then it's harder to adjust them depending on changing conditions. And again, there's also changing conditions in terms of society. And we saw this more in the 90s and 2000 cycles of redistricting where a lot of Democrats were talking about that white voters were particularly, and this is about racial gerrymandering, that white voters were more willing now to support black candidates. And so if we see that in 10 or 20 years, that continues to change, or maybe it goes in the reverse,
right. How
does that change legal rulings that are usually based on certain conditions and certain times in history where the viewpoints of black and white voters or other minorities about candidates from other minority groups change over time? And so it's I don't envy them.
Right.
that's what they signed up to do.
Right.
But it seems as though the whole idea of having a ruling that can withstand a generation of other litigation just seems difficult, given the fact that times change. All you know, times are always changing.
It's incredibly complex. To your point, Paul Clement, who argued for the defendants on Tuesday, he said a lot of things. I guess I would just note quickly, he hit on the fact several times that there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution about what you mentioned before of there being any kind of proportional representation. And he pointed to single state representation like Nebraska or Wyoming, where you know, they both have Republican representatives. Every Democrat in that state is not represented, so to speak. I mean, every Democratic voter. And he also noted Massachusetts, where Massachusetts might have 10 members of Congress, but they're all Democrats, despite there being roughly a third of the electorate up there being registered Republicans. So an interesting case. I don't think there's an easy, quantifiable, tangible test or number for, hey, this is extreme, this isn't extreme. This is how partisan maps could be, but not be hyper-partisan or extreme partisan.
But if they do have a formula, if they do agree with the prong test, what an amazing change that will be for every state in the 2020 elections and 2020 redistricting cycle.
It would be a fundamental change to American politics, and I think I am just cynical that we're going to see that based on what happened last year, right? I mean, this big Wisconsin case came before the court. I think there was a lot of energy or optimism or whatever you want to call it. There was a lot of conversation about, oh, the way in which maps can be drawn will change after this. But, of course, it didn't, and Justice Kennedy retired. And Justice Kavanaugh does not have a record on this issue.
Well, what was your – quickly, I don't want to play host, but
no, please do.
Just give me one little nugget about what your experience was. You tell me that you went to the Supreme Court for the first time and were in the room, and you just give us one nugget maybe?
It was a lot of fun. It's a great building. I think that I might have been inside briefly when I was in the 7th or 8th grade, but I haven't been there as a professional. So it was a neat assignment. It was a great opportunity to be there. A lot of visiting press, and they lined us up, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, maybe 30 or 40 minutes before we needed to go upstairs. But I drew F3. That was my seat number. So they lined the D's up and the E's up, and then they said, you know, F3, 1 through 25 out in the hallway, now line up in numerical order. And we're like, wait, what? So we go outside in the hallway, and they bring us upstairs. There's a second security check. So you go metal detector into the building, then there's another metal detector before you go into the courtroom, because like many federal courtrooms, you can't have a cell phone, you can't have any kind of technology. And I go into the courtroom, and it is as you perhaps would picture a normal courtroom, where there's the bench straight on, and then there are plenty of seats. And on the right and the left, there are maybe 8 to 10 massive marble columns. And I went, and the reserve or the spillover seating for the media is on the left behind some of the marble columns. And I sat down. My seat was directly behind a marble column to the point where I wasn't going to be able to see really much of anything except for the reporters to my left and right. And I was like, this stinks. Like, I'm going to be in this seat for the next hour and a half, 2 hours, and I'm not going to get to see anybody. Fortunately, whoever drew F4 didn't show up.
Wow.
So I slid over one seat. I was next to a reporter from New York who I've actually covered some, I think, a voter ID case with, a guy named Ari Berman, who's written some, I believe he's written a couple of books. But anyway, I sat next to him, and I had a view of Justices Kavanaugh and Kagan. So I guess 1.5 or 2 justices is better than none.
Well, that's just still a great experience to do that. Being a Washington, D.C. area native, I don't believe I've ever been in the Supreme Court, so I need to make that a bucket list next time I go back there.
You do, and they've done a very good job of incorporating some of the history of the court and portraits. They've got a video and a decent cafeteria. So,
well, it's always important.
It is important. I'm surprised you've never been there.
I'm surprised too, but I can't recall it in my memory.
Gary Robertson here on the podcast posing questions, which is always appreciated. Sorry I didn't come up with anything better.
I thought it was a softball question.
It
frankly,
was a softball question. On that note, we'll go to baseball. And today is opening day of the 2019 season. Some over-under
props for you.
Oh, really?
Before we get you out of here.
All right.
Washington National wins in 2019, over under 86.5. Last year, they had 82.
I'm going to be a little optimistic and say over, because while the fact that Bryce Harper is not with us anymore, he's with the enemy up the road. I think this team still is generally made a lot of good offseason moves. Their pitching, particularly their starting pitching, is outstanding, and they're working on their relief. And look out for people like Anthony Rendon and Juan Soto. They're going to both stars coming.
So at least 87 wins.
I think 87 wins. Okay. I think so.
40 home runs for the new Philadelphia Phillies phenom, Bryce Harper, over or under. He's only, as a contextual note, he's only had more than 42 in 2015, the only time he had more than 40 in his career.
I think it'll be under, not because I don't appreciate who he was and how I rooted for him for many years in the red and white of at Nationals Park, but he is not I think that he will come into his own with a couple more years of seasoning in Philadelphia. I'm not saying it's going to be a bad year for him. I just don't see 40 home runs.
Baseball stadiums, major and or minor, that you will visit in 2019, over under 3. You can push 2.
My daughter, who is a Nationals fan with me, dropped a note letting me know that there's one weekend in June where the Nationals and the Orioles are in town the same weekend. So it's really put something in my mind that maybe I could go and hit two on the same weekend, hopefully. And I'm sure I'll make a trip to Durham Bulls Athletic Park. Does the Cary High School baseball field work out? Because I had, you remember, my sons used to play, and but I have not been back this year. But I bet y'all, I would say over. I'd probably find another minor league park somewhere.
Have you been to Camden Yards before?
You know what? It's hard to believe. I grew up an Orioles fan.
Yes, you did.
Spent at least, I can think of many great games at Old Memorial Stadium.
Yeah.
But I have never been to Camden Yards. I left for North Carolina after it.
Opened 93, 94,
yeah, maybe. Before it opened. And I just didn't come back. Life came, marriage, kids, and then the Nationals came, and my loyalties went directly to a team that I had wanted all my life.
I hope you get there. That is, don't tell anybody, that is my favorite ballpark. I love Fenway.
Really?
But Camden Yards is maybe next to Fenway. Camden Yards is a phenomenal ballpark. So hopefully you get there.
I should.
In 2019. State House reporter for the Associated Press, Gary Robertson, thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Glad to be here.
You can subscribe to the program. Leave us a review as well if you care to do so on iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. Stay up to date with whatever is happening at your North Carolina legislature throughout the week at our website, wunc.org. For Gary, I'm Jeff. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you soon.